So imagine a total nationwide blackout right now. Complete darkness, not in some remote war zone, but sitting literally just 90 miles off the coast of Florida.
Yeah, it's honestly wild to think about.
Right. And that is the current reality in Cuba today. It's driven by this unprecedented shift in U.S. strategy. So welcome to today's deep dive, where we are going to unpack the geopolitical paradox of U.S.-Cuba relations. Just a quick note for you up front. The sources we're looking at today contain some pretty politically charged content.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, so we want to be super clear. We are completely impartial here. We are definitely not endorsing any viewpoints or policies, just objectively reporting the facts and strategies laid out in these recently declassified documents.
Exactly. Just following the data wherever it leads.
Yeah. Okay, let's unpack this. Back in 1823, John Quincy Adams had this theory. He called Cuba a ripe fruit that gravity would just inevitably pull into the American orbit.
And what's fascinating here is that this gravitational pull, you know, it isn't some Cold War invention. The U.S. has viewed Cuba as this indispensable strategic asset for centuries. Like, if you look at the Austin Manifesto from 1854.
Oh, right. Way before the Cold War.
Exactly. Long before Soviet missiles were even a thing. Okay. The U.S. actually proposed buying Cuba for $130 million. It was this massive domestic power play. Southern politicians wanted to annex Cuba to expand slavery and basically stack Congress with pro-slavery votes. They were openly threatening war if Spain refused.
Wait, seriously? $130 million back in 1854? That obsession runs incredibly deep. But I guess that brings us to the real paradox here. If the U.S. institutional desire for Cuba is that entrenched, why is this relationship permanently frozen today? I mean, but wait, we successfully normalized relations with Vietnam in 1995. Is Cuba just the geopolitical equivalent of a bad breakup we refuse to get over?
It kind of looks that way on the surface, but the underlying mechanics of their economies went in complete opposite directions. Mm-hmm. Vietnam offered this strategic counterweight to China, right? And they embraced those capitalist Doi Mor reforms.
So they decentralized and opened up.
Precisely. They systematically encouraged private enterprise. But Cuba suffers from what political scientists call the lawnmower effect.
The lawnmower effect.
Yeah. Basically, the moment any private sector or independent civil society grows enough to get leverage, the state mechanism just sweeps in and cuts the grass down. Mm-hmm. They do it to preserve absolute political control.
Oh, man, the lawnmower effect. That is a brutal analogy. And from the U.S. side, it's not just some executive policy you can easily flip. It's a structural trap, right? Like, the sources point heavily to the Helms-Burton Act of 1996.
Yeah, that law is a massive structural hurdle.
Right, because Congress basically confiscated the president's diplomatic steering wheel. It demands a legal resolution for the $1.9 billion in uncompensated U.S. property that was seized back in 1960.
Right. It legally locks the U.S. into this hardline stance. But even if a president could somehow bypass Helms-Burton, you have to look at who actually controls Cuba's wealth today. And that brings us to GES.
Okay, yes. And here is where it gets really interesting for me. Because wouldn't unconditionally lifting the embargo and allowing free trade just naturally help the average Cuban citizen?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the answer in these documents is a hard no. GIETAS is this totally opaque Cuban military conglomerate, and they control roughly 40% of the economy. We're talking ports, retail chains, tourism, everything.
So the money just wouldn't reach the street.
Not at all, because the state intercepts it. The source argues that unconditional free trade wouldn't democratize the island. It would just directly recapitalize a hostile military dictatorship.
Wow, which perfectly tees up the climax of these documents, right? The 2025 to 2026 U.S. maximal pressure campaign, or the Donroe Doctrine.
Yeah, this is where the strategy shifts dramatically.
Right, so the U.S. basically weaponized Cuba's absolute reliance on imported energy. First, there was a raid in Venezuela to capture Nicolas Maduro, which physically severed Cuba's oil supply.
And then they immediately followed that physical strike with a financial chokehold through Executive Order 14404. This created a maritime energy blockade using aggressive secondary sanctions. Basically, the U.S. tells the global market, if your shipping company or bank facilitates an oil transfer to Cuba, you lose access to the U.S. dollar completely.
you're just totally exiled from the global financial system.
Exactly. And that financial chokehold is what triggered those nationwide blackouts we talked about at the start.
It's crazy. So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Why should you care? Well, this is basically a real-time masterclass in how superpowers use economic choke points and asymmetric warfare, and it's happening right in your geographic backyard.
It's incredibly effective at starving the regime's infrastructure, but it does leave this massive geopolitical blind spot.
Right, because if the U.S. energy blockade successfully triggers the total collapse of the Cuban regime, who actually steps in to rebuild it? I mean, is it going to be a newly democratic Cuban civil society? Or will it be foreign adversaries like China and Russia, who already operate active intelligence bases on the island? It's definitely something to think about as that ripe fruit finally starts to detach from the branch.